Welcome to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm your host, Derek Brose. In every episode of this podcast, we're going to explore solutions in the areas of health, permaculture, growing your own food, technology. We'll be interviewing guests who are providing important solutions that are more important than ever in this time we are living in. The Activation Podcast is focused on bringing you cutting-edge solutions to empower humanity. All right, this is Derek Brose, and welcome to another episode of the Activation Podcast. Let's just jump right into it. This is a, I think, going to be an interesting conversation because, Henna, this is our first, you know, time talking via interviews via the web. We got to connect in person here in Mexico a couple months back, and I've seen your name popping up over the last 6 months or so. I think we spoke at similar events and saw that you were somebody focused on similar topics to myself, including technocracy, spirituality, and a range of other interesting intersecting topics. And so I wanted to just bring you on the podcast. Of course, on this podcast, I specifically, we try to focus on solutions, giving people tools of empowerment. So I want to see how you and I can handle that conversation and where we might take it, what interesting places we might take it. But before we dive into all that, maybe you can just give my audience a little bit of background on yourself and the type of work you do and what brought you to this point.
Thank you, Derek. It's amazing to be on the show. So yeah, I fully resonate with everything you're doing, by the way. So when I first discovered you, I was like, oh my God, it's like I am totally aligned with your message. So it's beautiful to connect. And it was so nice to meet you in Mexico in person. Yeah, so a little bit about my background. I've been an activist about the last 16 years, but it's only the last 2 years with the whole COVID crisis that I kind of came out in the public eye. So I've been very much like a street activist, and my causes have been animal rights, human rights. I worked a little bit for Amnesty International 13 years ago. And yeah, I've been trying different ways to approach like the crisis of the world, you know. And what really brought the center to my work is when I discovered healing arts. So I started learning indigenous healing arts and specifically Amazonian plant medicine. And that seemed to bring me to the core of where I believe all of this crisis and all of this pain and conflict is rising from, which is trauma. So it started with my own healing journey, healing myself, and then realizing that it's the same recipe for healing the collective. So it's all about trauma work, really. And so now the last couple of years, I've been combining everything that I learned from the healing arts to my activism. And so I started Dawn of Peace, which is a collective of peacemakers, 2019, right before all this, which I feel is kind of, you know, synchronistic. And the causes that I felt very drawn to were also medical freedom and freedom from like technocracy and implantable technologies, the right to, you know, govern your own body and natural law, you know, human rights, animal rights, all of this. So it's been amazing to see how all of those things that I've been looking into became kind of like a lifeline now over the last 2 years. So because we are under attack in so many ways. And so my work, really like the golden thread of all of it, is what it means to be a human being. How do we heal ourselves? And then through there, how do we heal this world? How do we heal our communities? And then...
I was just going to add real quick. I mean, I feel like the reason we resonate so well with each other is because everything you just described is, you know, obviously we've taken different paths, but coming to that realization of how important healing is in the bigger picture of what we're fighting for. So I definitely think that's why we're connecting on such a deeper level. So please continue. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I was going to tell about the work with the police as well. So that's something that I did not foresee, but I was kind of just thrown into this. So, I founded this international movement, Police for Freedom, because I got to make friends with some beautiful police officers here in Spain who started an association called Policías por la Libertad in 2021. And so I saw that part of the issue, what is causing conflict in this COVID era, is the polarization. And of course, as an anarchist, I did not foresee myself to be working together with police, but I saw that that was something that I needed to heal in myself, this prejudice and this judgment. And I was called to see beyond the uniform into the human being. And I saw how these police were handling demonstrations. So they were starting their own demonstrations, defending human rights, and the way they were directing the liaison with the on-duty police officers, I witnessed how there was literally no brutalities, no arrests, no pepper sprays, nothing. It was like the most peaceful demonstrations that I'd ever witnessed. So I got to talking to them and said, look, guys, this has to become an international thing. Like, we need to spread this message of liaison and transparency and communication and seeking to work together rather than like work against each other. And so they said, look, none of us speak English, so you got to do it. Like, you're an activist, you have experience of your side of seeing the things. So maybe you can be a bridge to communicate that, look, being an activist doesn't mean that you have to hate cops. So then, we did that. And in February 2021, we started Police of Freedom. And now we have, I believe, 16 chapters around the world. And they're led by either former or currently serving police officers together with activists. And it's been beautiful to see the healing that happens when you get to hear both sides of the story. You know, what is causing police to be violent, which most of the time is also trauma. You know, they suffer with a tremendous amount of PTSD. They are constantly put in situations where they just receive a lot of hatred. You know, we all have that kind of ingrained belief that when police is around, there's going to be trouble. But it doesn't have to be that way. So I'm really passionate about breaking those prejudices and going straight into the human, right beyond, you know, the uniform, and helping to inspire, helping to rehumanize, you know, our relationships with the police. And I've witnessed how it works.
That sounds really, you know, beautiful, and I think also might be kind of difficult for someone in the audience to take in and hear. You know, I definitely over the years have, I'm not the kind of person who takes the sort of, you know, fuck all the police sort of approach, right? For one, I've had family members who did their best. They thought they were going to become a police officer and go in and sort of change the system. And I think in small ways, maybe they did do some good. I also have an aunt who ultimately left because of corruption within the police department. So, you know, I have had experience with family members being in that arena. So whenever in my activism over the last 12 years, I haven't really tried to just approach every officer, every cop in that way. I've also, you know, been thrown to the ground by cops and had some, you know, aggressive instances happen as well. But still within that, I do think it's important to, as you said, see the human in there, right? And also to acknowledge the trauma on the other side of the equation. And, you know, there's also structural issues and things we could get into that happen with the police. And this might be, you know, internationally, worldwide, different issues that come up with cops, because police brutality isn't, unfortunately, isolated to one country or one region of the world. You know, it does happen elsewhere. But I think what you're getting at is so important. And I'm sure that even within the audience of this podcast, which I would say are the, you know, the holistic anarchist, the spiritual anarchist, that there might be some resistance to that. So maybe could you talk a little bit more about that, like in your own, you know, your own life or your own experience, and then maybe even just by trying to spread this concept, like how has it been for you to see people maybe resistant to this idea, and maybe not even just resistant, but wholeheartedly push back and say, hell no, we're not working with cops. Like, have you had difficult experiences like that, convincing people that this is a worthy venture?
Yes, definitely. And like I said, I had to first go through that in my own self and examine what is the resistance in me. And I think one of the most important things for us to look at is what we perceive as violence. And I believe the institution of the police, you know, the organization is inherently violent. But then when we look at other institutions like the medical establishment, we begin to see far more systematic and insidious expressions of violence. So I don't know if you want to go into like the topic of the injections and stuff, but when you see that, you know, medical mistakes and iatrogenesis is actually at the top three causes of death worldwide, then we have to ask ourselves and say, why do we as anarchists have the license to hate police, but nobody speaks about the violence that nurses and doctors are doing every day to newborn babies, expecting mothers, the elderly, people in risk groups? So if that is the issue, that these people represent a violent institution, then, you know, looking at the system as a whole, you cannot deny that there are other institutions that are far more violent than that, you know? And of course, there's the military and all these things. So I see that it's a cultural sickness that we have. Like the violence is imbued in everything, in different forms. Some of it is silent violence. So the police as an organization is inherently immoral the way that it is now. But if you look at the kind of, if there was a noble spiritual expression of the police, then that would be like angelic beings there to help you if you want, you know? So traditionally, policing should be about community and they're in service for you, right? They take an oath. Well, I know now a lot of the oaths are like you're pledging allegiance to the queen and stuff, which is, again, you know, totally immoral. But a lot of the police that sign up for the job genuinely want to do good. This is something I've come across over and over again. And speaking to police myself and asking, what does it feel to you? That immediately, because you wear the uniform, people make certain assumptions about your character and about your set of morals and about your values. And so a lot of the people that harbor this, you know, resentment towards the police, they don't have friends as cops. They've never met a police officer who's actually out there on the streets and is doing like incredible work right now. It is a minority, I have to say that. A large part of the police are order followers who learn that they get an easy paycheck and they, you know, they just follow whatever they're told. But there are these gems among there. And I believe that that is what we need to reinforce. Because also, if we say that if you see what's happening in the world and you understand where we're going, you should quit your job as a police. That to me is a huge problem as well, because then we will literally only be left with the crooks and the criminals and the order followers. And you won't have those who can think with their own brain and who have a big heart and who want that community policing and want to communicate and respect the fellow human being. You remove that completely, then we're in deeper trouble then. And I believe that there are all these other, you know, influences and agendas that are driving in this police hatred, you know, through the media a lot. We never hear about the good engagements, the positive engagements with the police. You never see, you know, footage from a successful demonstration where everything's been completely peaceful. You only ever see the violence. And then they rile up this defund the police movement, thinking that that is some kind of a solution to the issue, when in fact, when you do that, then what happens? You know, my fear is that they are trying to get rid of local police and bring in some kind of one world militarized police. And we can already see the way the police uniform is changing. They're no longer wearing their identity tags. Everything's going black. They're becoming more and more dehumanized by the way that they dress. You know, they have their helmets, their shields. Like, you might as well be looking at a robot. And perhaps that is where this is going. You know, maybe in 2030, we will have robocops on the street. So what I'm trying to do here is I'm not saying I'm championing the idea of or the organization of police, but to say, look, let's see beyond this and see if there's anything we can do to like take us away from that direction and help inspire some humanity in this and help, you know, restore some dignity behind the uniform. So that's my thing.
Yeah, I think that's there's a lot of really interesting pieces in there, and I hope everybody will take some time to digest that. You know, a couple of thoughts that come to mind that in my early activism, I definitely was aware of and to some degree collaborated with different organizations that exist in the United States. So, for example, there's the Oath Keepers organization, which is much different now than what it used to be. But originally, it was just, you know, about going around and finding currently serving and formerly serving police officers and military men and having them retake their oath to the Constitution and saying, like, you know, I will not disarm American citizens. I will not take people away to camps. You know, just these sort of like, hey, I'm agreeing that I'm going to stick by the people. And I thought that was a really valuable effort. There was also like the Constitutional Sheriffs Association. They would go around trying to encourage the sheriffs, you know, who obviously have a lot of power to say, hey, you know, recognize you're supposed to be the final say in your area. You get to reject unjust laws, bad laws. And so I've seen these efforts. And I do think that ultimately, you know, when we're looking at the agenda of 2030 and technocracy and all the things we're facing, and we get into the arena of solutions and getting free from these systems, that there will be a role, whether that's a role on the side of the people or a role on the side of the technocracy, for the police. You know, they're going to play a role. These people have been trained. And as you said, some of them have gone through PTSD and some traumatic events. And either there will be attempts like you're, you know, working on here to heal those relationships so that when things do get rough, they find themselves, you know what, I align more with the people than I do with, you know, this state and this technocracy. But that's going to take time. It's going to take effort, right? They're not automatically going to go from like, these people hate me, I'm ready to join them, you know, right, to, you know, just, you know, jumping away, yeah, from the technocracy. And one other point that came to mind, I do think there's some truth in the concerns that people have about the defund the police movement. I kind of see it from multiple perspectives. So I grew up around a lot of mainly like left-wing anarchists politically. And so the defund the movement, defund the police movement, defund prisons, et cetera, is something that I've been familiar with since 2005, you know, it predates any of this recent stuff we've seen, but it's never had as loud of a voice as we have now. And then you can go into some of the funding of the current more mainstream movements and see George Soros and some of those people. So I do think that while this movement, and personally, I work towards a world where prisons are unnecessary, police are unnecessary. Now that might take generations, and maybe it's a more of a pipe dream that humanity is not ready for yet, but it's something that I've been aware of prior to any of the recent stuff that people have heard about. So I just want to make that clear that for some people who've never heard of these movements and think that it only popped up after George Floyd's death, you know, be aware that there is a historical precedent of anarchists fighting to abolish police and abolish prison. This is something I'm sure you're aware of, but just for anybody who in the audience who might not understand that, but this is the way these people operate, is they might take an idea that exists and is out there and has some value and then try to corrupt it and say, okay, well, let's get rid of, as you mentioned, all of the local police. And then what are you left with? The police on the national level, the federal level, the international level, who often have no tie or no connection to the local community and really couldn't care about, you know, listening to the people and, you know, any appeals to humanity. I think that is absolutely a part of the plan. And the final thing that came to mind, that it's interesting, we're recording this conversation today because today on April 15th, I think it's the 15th or the 13th, we're approaching the anniversary of the community of Cheran, which is 2 hours away from where I live here in Mexico. And they're approaching their the 11th or the 12th anniversary of their uprising, where they successfully, because of survival instinct, they kicked out the corrupt cops who were working with the cartels, who were working with the corrupt government, and loggers who were working with all of them as well. They were logging their forest. They were messing with their water supply that their community had been drinking from and, you know, using for generations. And it got to the point where they grabbed sticks and stones and bricks and anything they could, and they fought back, and they successfully were able to kick this force out of their community. And for them, the answer was to go back to their indigenous ways of organizing, because in their part of Mexico and in lots of part of Mexico, political parties hadn't even been there until the last 30, 40 years, which is kind of crazy for people to think about, that these, wow, communities in parts of Mexico had no involvement with the political system. And then one day the politicians started coming in there, started campaigning. And once this uprising began and they pushed back against the cartel and the cops, they all came together and was like, okay, well, what do we do now? What's next? You know, we're kind of, we stood up now, but what comes after that? Now we got to fight for our freedom. And eventually the federal government recognized them as an autonomous indigenous region. And they've now been existing for 11 years without cops, without cartels, without government. You know, they have outside government. They have their own way, of course, of organizing within. And they do have a community defense force, which we could call police if we wanted to. But it's something that's more local. It's volunteer. The people that are involved are directly from the community. They're not coming from the United Nations or from the Mexico City or anywhere else. So I just wanted to share that as an example, that I think that for me, the ultimate goal is to rethink what we consider police to be, as you're kind of talking about here, maybe what they were originally intended to be, you know, or, you know, just rethinking that idea, because there is going to be a need for the warriors within the community to come and defend whenever that time is necessary and to protect the people. And so, yeah, maybe the goal then is to just, as you, I think, are doing here, and it sounds like such a worthy effort, trying to get people to rethink the way that they approach police and police the way they approach activists and individuals.
Yeah, totally. That's very something in work. Australia that we've witnessed. That was the first chapter actually that opened. It was in March 21, the Police of Freedom in Melbourne, that there was this, it was like this baggage of trauma that everyone was carrying. You know, there had been so many you know, negative engagements and conflicts and, you know, outright brutality on the streets, that the idea of Police for Freedom was like, everyone was like, no freaking way. Like, we're not collaborating with these, you know, assholes. But then just by communicating and starting to organize workshops about like nonviolent action strategies and being present on the streets, people began to, you know, find trust in these guys and said, all right, well, what have you got to offer? And slowly, slowly, the kind of general perspective or the general kind of, you know, way to view police started to shift, that maybe it is not the most intelligent strategy to go directly against zero tolerance public order unit commands. Like, do you realize that by doing that, you are only causing yourself more trauma? There's going to be violence. If they say we have zero tolerance, this is lockdown, you cannot come to the streets, then maybe it's not wise strategy to go at the center of the city where they can block you in and kettle you and just, you know, be in the receiving end of mayhem. Maybe more intelligent strategy is to talk to some police who are awake and together collaborate and form strategies where it's, instead of like one centralized big demonstration at the heart of the city, you have multiple smaller, you know, outside of the center, smaller demonstrations where you don't have the resources to put big, you know, special units in there, where you can do it in local towns. And a whole other kind of movement started to form where people realized that there is ways to work around this. We don't have to, you know, clash heads to head constantly with the police. So I think it's all about finding ways to communicate and realize, you know, like, what is the merit of liaison? What is the merit of alternative strategies? And that's really what we want to facilitate with the chapters that we have. It's not that, you know, we've come here to save the world, but just to say, like, there are different ways of doing things, and there are ways to work around these commands that come from these public order units or whatever, you know, these enforcers. Yeah, another thing, you know, if we think of like the work of the police, of course, what is valuable is investigations. So this is something that the Dutch Police of Freedom chapter is doing now. They've started their own investigation bureau, which is for the people, and it's based on morals and freedom. So they actually have like office hours in secret locations where people can come and bring them evidence, and they're starting to investigate crimes against humanity, and they are doing it properly. Like the guy who's heading it, Dennis Spanstra, who's the head of Police of Freedom there, he is specialized in interrogation and murder investigations. So what a better guy to have on the side of people to start gathering evidence. And they're not doing it to bring it to court, because we know the court system is completely corrupt. They're doing it so that we have evidence of what's happening, and they're constantly publishing it. So it's to raise awareness and to have the other side see that we know what you're doing and we're onto you. So to create also a little bit of pressure that there are going to be consequences at some point, I do believe that these crimes are going to be exposed. So this is something that we're building now, systems where we can have such investigation bureaus in different countries around the world, where the good police can conduct their own independent investigations because the organization is not doing it. Nobody's doing it.
Well, that sounds really, really phenomenal, because I agree with you as far as, you know, everybody who follows my work knows that I talk about exiting from the systems, building better systems. And yeah, part of that would be accountability, right? I mean, holding people accountable for crimes, whether we're talking about the crimes against humanity that we've seen the last 2 years and before then as well, or just, you know, low level offenses that somebody is going to need to be able to take care of and to investigate. And clearly there are police around the world who do have those skills, police who are actual investigators and who know how to use those skills and to track evidence and do all those things. So that's pretty amazing. I would love for us to, if you can share with me, or if you can share right now, and I'll include it in the show notes, a place or people who might be interested in starting a chapter of this in their own community or just learning more. Is there anywhere online that they can go to?
Yeah, policeoffreedom.org.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. Great. Well, so I wanted to take a step back. You mentioned when you were kind of sharing about your journey, plant medicine. And first off, I just want to, like, let's get into that a little bit further for those who might be totally unfamiliar. You said Amazonian plant medicine. Could you elaborate on that and how you came across plant medicine in your journey and just the ways it's helped you?
Yeah, so ayahuasca specifically is the medicine that I'm specialized in. And the way it came into my life was that I was carrying a trauma that was unresolvable for me. I already accepted by that time that there's no way to heal it. So my first partner took his own life. And in our culture, that is the kind of a trauma that everyone says that you're just going to have to live with for the rest of your life. Like, there's no way to heal that level of pain and you know, shame and anger and grief and all of the, you know, various burdens that come when someone you love take their own life. So then, that was in 2013 that I met my husband, and he'd just come back from the Amazon rainforest, and he'd experienced this medicine, and he told me that this is something that I believe would be able to help you. And so it took me some time to sit with that, because I was, of course, terrified to face that trauma again. But it just became a very strong calling that I do need to try this out, that if this is my last straw, you know, I tried everything else, therapy and art therapy and all sorts of things, and nothing was even close to touching, you know, to resolve that. So I went for my own self-healing, and it was no less than miraculous how I was able to find total peace with that trauma. And then, of course, I realized that there was so much more. That was just the tip of the iceberg, you know, ancestral things from my childhood. And so I dove very deep into my own personal self-healing. And from that gift of getting a little taste, a glimpse of peace, you know, in those ceremonies, I felt that this is something I need to bring to my friends and family. I need, because I'm surrounded by people. Well, we all are. Our culture is just full of trauma, right? So it started out as a kind of a calling that maybe I could help one of my friends one day. And then in my apprenticeship, it got stronger and stronger that this is actually my life path, that this is something that I'm kind of born to do. That I absolutely fell in love with the indigenous wisdom and their way of carrying themselves in this world, just with such nobility and grace and wisdom. And yeah, I just found myself completely enveloped in that culture. And yeah, it took me about 5 years of really serious immersion in that field. And then, yeah, I was initiated to start holding ceremonies myself.
Hold that thought. Hey guys, this is Derek Bros with the Activation Podcast. And I want to tell you about a new project that I recently launched. It's called the Holistic Self-Assessment Online Course. And it's based on my 2018 book, The Holistic Self-Assessment. Now, some of you guys know that I released this book based off my experiences in prison. This is essentially the culmination of the process I took myself through while I was locked up behind bars, when I began meditating, when I began journaling, and really starting to heal my trauma and begin to align my thoughts, my words, my actions, and really live in line with my true purpose. So this book is meant to be a self-empowerment, self-help guide that helps you align your thoughts, words, and actions, your relationships, your habits, and make sure you are living in line with your goals and your principles. So I developed this 9-week course with the University of Reason, aka Autonomy. We put this course together for people like yourself to take it and walk through it chapter by chapter. I read the book with you. I give you tips and exercises. And there's actually two options. If you want to just do the DIY version, you can choose to work through the course yourself. If you'd like to pay a little bit of extra money, you can go ahead and get one-on-one sessions with myself, where I will counsel you and work through the book with you and answer any questions you have. So I really want to encourage you guys to check this out. The link will be in the description below where you are listening or watching. And I'll put the link to the Holistic Self-Assessment book as well, which you can download for free. And I want you to stay tuned, because we're getting ready to release the Holistic Self-Assessment audiobook, the Spanish version of the book, and an upcoming Holistic Self-Assessment 9-day challenge. So stay tuned, guys. Now let's get back to the podcast.
That's wonderful. Can you say anything about the specific indigenous people that you're working with or have worked with?
Yeah, it's the Shipibo tribe. So I've also sat with the Mestizo and the Shuar in Ecuador. But why the Shipibo were the ones that really captured my soul in a way that I was so inspired to learn with them is that they use this medicine of the Icaros, which is the healing song. So anyone who's sat in ceremony with the Shipibo, they know what I'm talking about. They have a very special way of singing. And that is the way that they facilitate the healing. So it's not that they heal you is that they bring in this energy through the songs. It's a channeling. These songs are received in the apprenticeships. So they're actually called diets or dietas in Spanish. It's when you go into a spiritual communion. So it's a prolonged period of fasting where you are in complete isolation from everyone, which reminds me a little bit of your journey, what you shared in your book about being in prison and coming to find yourself, basically. So they do that voluntarily. They put themselves into these prolonged periods of silence. And while they're in the spiritual communion, they ingest the medicine plant. And then this connection, this relationship begins to develop, and you begin to perceive the communication of this specific tree or plant. And that may sound like super wild and out there, and something that even for me was difficult to grasp, that is it really true that trees can teach you? But I tell you, they absolutely can. And so when you develop this relationship, the trees begin to give you songs, and you literally receive melodies and words. And so that becomes like the surgeon's tool or the stethoscope, the device that you use in ceremony to channel this healing energy into the space. So they're not songs that you yourself make. These are songs that you receive from higher realms. And this is the art of the Shipibo people, and they are masters of it. And so when you learn with them, they help you tune into that, how to work with this song, the medicine of the song. So that's what I sing to people.
that's really beautiful. And I'll just share, I've talked about this maybe years ago, but not too much with my audience. But I had my ayahuasca experience in 2012, you know, whenever, shortly after waking up and getting out of prison, as you mentioned, and sort of beginning my spiritual path. And also just reconnecting to my family's indigenous roots, starting to go to ceremony, to Sweat Lodge, and to Sundance, and other, you know, other different events that were bringing me towards indigenous medicine, indigenous wisdom. And the song is absolutely vital, absolutely important. And that's something that has stuck with me. It's been 10 years now since my ayahuasca experience, because mainly I felt like I got the medicine I needed that night. And, you know, it sort of shifted me in a number of ways. But I think that it is extremely important for people to understand that, especially as you said, for the Western mind, it can be difficult to grasp some of these concepts. Obviously, plant medicine has become more popular in recent years, but I think there are still some, and maybe even some in this audience who might come across it, who, you know, could be skeptical, or, you know, you're just taking drugs or whatever sort of response that they might have. But I want to recommend for anybody who this is totally new to, and maybe it's something you're familiar with, a book called The Cosmic Serpent by Jeremy Narby. He's an amazing writer, and he actually has multiple books that go deeper into this. But the first book, Cosmic Serpent, actually deals with his time with the Shipibo people and the 70s, I want to say. And he went there as an anthropologist, sort of Western mind, rational, logical, let me study these people. And then over time, he decides, you know what, I'm going to take them for what they're worth. Says. So when they tell me the plants told them how to make the ayahuasca brew, how to combine the root, how to combine this, I'm just going to, you know, trust them. When they say that the plants are giving them the messages, I'm just going to, you know, dive in fully. And so he approached with that, not only with that, you know, that humility and that sort of, hey, maybe I don't know what's going on around here. This isn't my arena. And it changed his life. It radically changed his life, and it connected him to Mother Ayahuasca, and into kind of getting to understand the relationship between ayahuasca, tobacco, and the other plant medicines. And it led to him writing this book, The Cosmic Serpent, and coming to really truly believe in the power of plant medicine, but also the spirits in the plants. And he's written subsequent books, including a book called Intelligence in Plants. And I think that those are just great starting points for anybody who might be interested, but maybe not ready to dive in just yet, but want to know more about that. His books are a great starting point. So The Cosmic Serpent by Jeremy Narby. And then I had a question for you. You know, what do you say to, or what are your thoughts for, because maybe you've come across it as well, to people who do have that feeling of like, you're just taking drugs, or even, and I've seen this within the various intersecting truth, freedom, spirituality communities. There are often people who identify as Christian or Catholic or whatever, you know, and it's nothing against those religions, but from their religious standpoint, they look at something like ayahuasca and they say, you're talking to the devil, or those are demons. Those are, you know, have you come across those reactions, and how do you approach that?
Definitely. I was raised Lutheran, you know, Christian myself, and I never touched drugs. So for me, I also had to face that. I had to, okay, what if this is something dark? So that comes, of course, from complete nations, you know. It's not ignorance because we actually don't know about it. So we're completely oblivious to what that world is. But when you start looking into the ancient cultures and you realize that a lot of them have you know, they've blossomed from these plants, that these have been along humanity from time immemorial. So we've developed, we've spiritually developed alongside with them. So there are instances from even, you know, the Christian origins where people would commune with plants. So it is a sacrament. So, you know, why do the people take wine in the church? You know, so it's all about intention. It's about which intention you put into it. And I see that this creation is sacred. So the plants that grow from the bosom of the Mother Earth, they are sacred. So there's nothing to fear about that. But what you do have to be very careful with is the intention that is taken with and the space. Is it taken in a reverent way? Is there someone there who's been initiated and who fully understands how these medicines work? Because what they do is they tune your consciousness, a bit like we can tune an instrument. So what these plants are designed to do and why they are on this earth, in this creation, is that they help us realign and they help tune our instrument. So you have to be in a space where there's someone who knows exactly what they're doing, that because otherwise it can be dangerous. It can. And what happens when you take these medicines, it lifts the veil. So we are in this five sense crude reality, but in reality, we are surrounded by so many different dimensions, you know, existing at the same time around us and filled with spirit beings. So a lot of the religious people, they believe that there's only demons, angels, and Jesus Christ. Well, that's not true. There's as many spirits as there are animals and insects on this earth visible. It's more than that, what kind of spirits exist. And they have different purposes and they have different natures. Some of them are, you know, benevolent, some are malevolent. So when you take these substances that tune your consciousness to be able to perceive that realm, which is here all the time around us, and we do sense it, but we can't see it. So these plants help us become fully aware of that reality. And so if you don't have someone in the space who knows how to communicate with the spirits, who knows how to set a protection where nothing can come in, which could be malevolent, then it can be dangerous. So you do have to be, you know, in a fully protected space so that then you can focus on what is the purpose of these medicines, which is to heal. Because another beautiful thing they do is they remove our you know, defense mechanisms and the coping systems we have so that we're able to perceive ourselves with full honesty. It's like looking into the mirror, you know? And so all these traumas that we carry from childhood and even from our ancestry, it's very difficult to access in our kind of normal waking consciousness because we have these coping mechanisms there. They are there to protect us so we can survive. But until we face those traumas, we are enslaved by them. They keep haunting us. They do. And so what the medicines help us do is to confront these traumas. And because we're in a different state of consciousness, we are tapping into our true self, you know, our true nature, which is filled with wisdom and patience and peace and love, then we're able to see even those traumas, even most horrendous things like rape or even ritual abuse, with a different, you know, different understanding, and liberate those burdens and forgive. And then we heal. So it is an immense spiritual journey when you go into ceremony with these plants, and it's not for the faint-hearted. You have to be brave to really face yourself and your life completely. But that is the gift that they offer as well, is you can then finally liberate yourself.
I think that's great the way you said that, because the forgiveness and the heal is such an important part of the healing. And for anybody, and I think that whether, you know, for one, you know, thank you for sharing with us about, you know, the trauma that you've been working through. And, you know, I've shared my story, and I'm sure listeners have their own versions of their stories. And those things do stick with us until you are ready to face them. And like you said, they come up in sort of unconscious, unseen ways. And the medicines can be valuable. And I will also echo what you said about the set and setting and the environment that you go into these things. There, because of the growth of interest in ayahuasca and ibogaine and other plant medicines that are just incredible teachers and healers and conduits for healing, there is also the growth of like the eco resort space. And I would definitely say that not all these spaces are created equally, right? Not everybody is going into it with the same intention. Maybe not everybody is even coming at the plants and the medicines with the same respect that, many shamans would approach them with, that I think any shaman who understands these medicines would approach them with. So it is important to understand all those things, just like, even getting, outside of just the Amazonian plant medicines. I spent a lot of time in my past both abusing and then learning to respect things like mushrooms and even MDMA for healing sessions and psychedelics. And those medicines can be, I think, a little bit more difficult to process. They can be more random. And again, if you're just getting something from a random person on the street, that might not be the ideal setting. If you're just in a room full of people partying, you might not get the same thing we're going for. But when done correct with intention, with intention and in the right setting with somebody that you trust, maybe even with, a partner or a friend that you can really go deep with those medicines, so much healing can take place. And there's nothing to be afraid of, I think, when it comes to those healing. And I think also it was a good point that you made there that, because I do think the Christian mindset, or, we can be broader than that, but the religious mindset would say, well, there's demons, there's angels, there's God, and there's Jesus. And anything else outside of that is, it's a trick. It's meant to deceive you. I get this a lot from people who say things like meditation is to put demons in your mind. Yoga is really, it's demonic. Those plant medicines, they're, you think you're seeing something, but it's really just infected. And to me, what I hear is a lot of fear. I hear fear coming from a place of, for one, ignorance, like, what experience do you have with these realms? So how would you really know? But it's kind of a fear of what could take place, what could happen. And I think that whether that comes from religious background or people who might even be totally atheistic, that fear is rooted in the ego's desire to not change and to not be, like, no, that's uncomfortable. That sounds rough. That sounds difficult. I might actually have to let go of my trauma. And this trauma, as much as I don't like it, it's become a comfortable security blanket. So I'd rather hold on to that than go into these unknown realms. And that's not to say that at least for me, that ayahuasca or any of these substances are the only way people can achieve healing and work through trauma. I've gone through other modalities, but I often do find that the resistance to healing in general comes from a place of fear. Is that something you've come across as well?
Yeah, there has to be a ripening, there has to be a readiness. So this is something that I would never convince anyone to do. So because it takes so much will and self-love to be able to then integrate, all those experiences. So when you go into ceremony, that's one thing. But the other thing is, how do you apply all the lessons that you receive in ceremony in your everyday life? And how do you then choose differently when you can no longer claim ignorance, because you've now become aware how your behavior is affecting others, for instance, or how your communication is, creating conflicts. Or so because you look into the mirror, you get a lot of knowledge on yourself. And this can be very hard to handle. And I relate to what you said about the comfort blanket. For me, when I healed this trauma, there was first a sense of liberation, but then came an emptiness, because I had totally identified with the victim, for years already. So my kind of way to comfort myself would be that, I'm this, broken woman, I'm this broken child from a broken family, I have all this trauma, nobody loves me, nobody understands me, and I don't belong anywhere. And so when that wasn't there anymore, I was like, who am I then? So I had to completely rebuild myself. So that was daunting at first. Like, how do I orient myself? How do I comfort myself now when the victim story has been taken away from me? Because I got to see that even that trauma, had deeper meaning for both myself and for my partner who left that way. So it takes a lot of responsibility, to step on the path of healing. Doesn't matter if it's with the plants or with any kind of, therapies or modalities. Can I say one thing, what we mentioned about the religious thing? Because I have an interesting story for you.
So I just wanted to echo real quick so people can hear it twice and really hammer in the importance. Personal responsibility. I mean, so much of what we're facing right now is requiring radical personal responsibility. spiritually, mentally, physically, you know, it's just so important. And thank you for sharing that. Please continue.
Yeah. So about the whole religious thing, what is interesting, when I discovered that all of the most skilled and dedicated healers that I met, indigenous people in the Amazon rainforest, were all working together with Christ. And they would say, do not enter a Catholic church. Okay, no offense to anyone who's Catholic, but that they have completely, you know, destroyed our culture. And basically they saw them as something evil. So they had nothing to do with religion. They had nothing to do with church, but they would sing for Christ in ceremony. So for them, it's not a question of belief. It's like they are connecting to a being on the other side who has immense power to heal. So, you know, you'd be surprised if you go out there in the jungle and you see these indigenous guys chanting for Christ. So it's not what you think, you know, like if you really believe that there is such a being out there, which is like the highest emanation of love and mercy, then do you really think that he only appeared to a certain people, you know, in Israel at a certain time? Or do you think he is way beyond that and has come to all cultures at all times, and that people know him and love him even if they are not part of the church? So this was something very interesting for me, is to see how the indigenous, you know, have met these different spirit beings, totally, you know, unrelated to any kind of religion.
Yeah, that's really important. I think that's it's interesting. You know, we could spend several hours just dissecting that alone, because, so for example, where I'm in Mexico, there's a lot of Catholic influence. There's a lot of Spanish influence, you know, the 15th century Spanish architecture, which everybody likes to marvel at. And it's really beautiful. And I myself, I can appreciate it. But there's also for me an understanding of, like, this is the buildings of colonization. This is the buildings of coming in and convincing the indigenous people that their ways were wrong and they needed to give their lives over to Christ. And then in some cases, it's similar to what you were describing, where you'll find this sort of mixing and merging of Christianity, Catholicism, and indigenous ways. You know, there might be, for example, there's some parts of Mexico that have churches that from the outside look very traditional, very Catholic. And then inside, people are doing indigenous customs and traditions with the cross and with other things. So it is interesting to see how that merges. Well, I wanted us to, as we start to get to the end of this conversation today, you know, I appreciate everything you've shared so far. I wanted to bring it full circle now to the work that both of us have done on the topic of technocracy. And I would like to see how, if we can explain and maybe make it more clear to the viewer, how your work on healing relations with police officers, your work with healing yourself and encouraging others to, you know, have their healing journeys with plant medicine, how that for you relates to this overarching agenda that you're very aware of, I'm very aware of, the audience is aware of, Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, technocracy. How do these things, you know, go together or play together in your activism to, you know, raise awareness and to push back against technocracy?
Yeah, to me, it goes all back to the question of what it means to be a human being, you know, and how do we guard the essence of that in this time? And I'm aware that there is a huge majority in the world that are very scared to take that self-responsibility and to face what it means when you can no longer rely on these, you know, structures, these authorities, and what it means to stand as our own, you know, living woman or living man, as a sovereign being. And so what I feel is the remedy for that is community. And this is, of course, something that you are brilliant at creating with your freedom cells and everything. And this is what the police work is all about as well. What I'm doing is I'm trying to inspire a sense of community between the activists and the police so that we wouldn't have to recreate trauma with every demonstration that we are trying to create, you know? And so that is really the core of it for me is community, humanity. How do we speak to one another? And this is where communication comes in. You know, how do we speak in a nonviolent way? How do we alleviate polarity, which is coming from both sides, not just from the side of, you know, these technocrats that are telling that the unvaccinated are, you know, the plague of this world, but how do we treat our friends and family who have decided to take this specific medical intervention? Have we started to discriminate them? Have we turned our backs on them? Because if we have, then we are actively, you know, creating this split. So really, it's just about how do we embody love? What does love want in this moment? And that's the guiding force for me, because they are trying to destroy the heart of humanity with this whole technocratic agenda. It's all about the mind. It's all about the, you know, the brain implants, and it's trying to take out the spirit, because they talk about the evolution of humanity, but how can humans evolve through machines? Then you're evolving technology and machinery, not humanity, because we have all these incredible potentials and gifts and technology, sacred technologies in our own vessel, you know, in our own being. So how do we develop that more? How do we discover the potential that we have? And that we can do together. If we do it alone, then it's going to be a very long and hard path. But if we find the people around us that see eye to eye, then together, you know, we can rely on each other, and we can develop our gifts and build our communities and stay focused. I would say that is the main thing, is not to get entangled with the new whatever, you know, drama is arising, or whatever hook they're throwing our way, but just know that the solution is always the same. It's self-sustainability, community, humanity.
Absolutely. And you're right. Like, there's going to be, we're in the current phase of post-COVID, maybe, sort of, you know, and whatever's next. And there's going to be another thing for them to either distract us with, or to keep us in a state of fear, a state of panic. But you're right. The solutions remain the same. I mean, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. Building communities, getting out of their systems, working on our healing, rediscovering and reconnecting to our humanity. I mean, so you and I both agree then that what we're facing with this technocracy is, at its core, a spiritual battle. It is, you know, it's the physical, but it's much more than that. And I think that increasingly people are becoming aware of that. Do you find yourself, you know, coming away with a feeling that this is the reason you exist on this planet, like this time and place here on planet Earth? Because that's something that I've experienced very deeply in the last couple of years. It's become even more clear. But is that something that you find yourself, you know, having that awareness that this is why you manifested, this is why you're born onto this planet?
Yeah, I'm just getting like full body chills when you're saying that. Absolutely. You know, the initiations and spiritual tests that I was going through in my apprenticeship to be able to, you know, work as an ayahuasquera were extremely, extremely difficult, because you have to be able to face, you know, a lot of darkness when you're dealing with people who come with spiritual problems like curses or entities. So I felt that learning how to stay, you know, centered and in a high, you know, frequency of love when you're faced with darkness is exactly what we now have to do in our activism. So absolutely, yes, I feel that totally. And being surrounded with the indigenous people and seeing how they carry themselves and how they've been able to preserve their culture, you know, at least some of it, I feel is the solution to this time as well. Like, we cannot let go of our humanity. We have to keep singing. We have to keep dancing. And there's a saying, you know, in the indigenous culture that if you're not creative, then you're not fully human yet. And so the creativity, I feel that is a medicine to balance our activism as well. So we don't just keep, you know, kind of staring into the abyss and into the darkness and see what else is, you know, planned ahead, but keep our creativity alive. And then, yeah, through that, from that well of joy, we can just inspire so many more people than if we get, you know, captured by this darkness. So yeah, absolutely. I would say that I feel this is why I'm here.
Absolutely. And you're right. You know, as far as talking about the creativity and the imagination, that creation, that to me is, that's the connection to the inner child, right? That's the connection to your joy, your imagination. And that is what we need right now. We need to connect to the inner child and do the healing work as much as we need to connect to the inner child and reconnect to our joy, our passion, our excitement about the world before we were told, you know, it's time to grow up. It's time to give up on those silly childish things. Reconnect to that, because that's what we need right now. We need imagination to invent new systems, new way of living. We need healing to reconnect and process the trauma that we're all dealing with in different ways, and that collectively humanity is dealing with. You know, is there any other closing thoughts you would like to share with everybody? Anything you'd like to share? And of course, please let everybody know where they can find your work and just keep up with all the good things you're doing.
What final words? Discover your gift and give it away. You know, that's something that I think Picasso said. is we all have our own unique role in this. And we don't all have to strive to do X, Y, or Z. And maybe something I feel worthy of mentioning as well is that let's not create some kind of celebrity culture or where these influencers are people that we follow. But if you see something that is inspiring to you, do the same, or discover what is the you know, the contribution that you could put into all of this. And it always comes through what gives you joy. So if you discover what gives you joy, that's your gift. That is what you're meant to be doing. And then you do it. And that's all you need to worry about. So, you know, don't think that there's people that you need to follow and look up to and you know, try and become like. Use that inspiration to discover your own gifts and then, you know, step into service and give it away. And yeah, the way to find me, you can go to my website, hennamaria.community. And then if you'd like to check out what our Peace Collective is doing, that's dawnofpeace.org. And then, of course, the policeoffreedom.org is for the police.
Beautiful. I'll include all those links. This has been an amazing conversation, Hannah. I really just appreciate you taking the time to share with me and my audience. And I want to echo what you said there, that you don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow Hannah. Follow yourself. Follow your own dreams. You know, take inspiration from people like us. But absolutely, we need everybody to step up to their plate and find their joy and add that to what we're building here, because we can't do it alone. We're going to need as many beautiful hearts and minds working as possible. So I hope you guys will go back and, you know, revisit this conversation. We've talked about reconnecting with the police and maybe rethinking the way we relate to them and what potentials lie on the other side of healing that trauma. We've talked about the benefits of plant medicine and maybe even some of the criticisms of plant medicine and how all of this relates to the bigger picture that we are facing. Because without a doubt, I know in my heart, this is a spiritual journey. And I hope that more of you listening will come to that conclusion, because we need you to step up, find your joy, and share those gifts with us. So thank you so much for listening. This has been the Activation Podcast. Until next time, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace.
Thank you for listening to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. You can find the archives of our show on Spotify, Pinecast, and at theconsciousresistance.com. Thanks for listening.